The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Potterverse is brought to you by MinuteWithMary.com. Here we are in the month of August, and my treat for you is a 15% off discount on my new eye cream. I know that many of us are wearing face masks nowadays, so our eyes are really kind of like the main part of our face that's showing. And if you feel like your eyes look a little dull or dark or have some fine lines or bags that you want to work on, my eye cream is bananas good. It's going to help brighten and tighten those under eyes. It's going to help with the fine lines around your eyes. So check it out now. You can actually go to minutewithmary.com/discount to grab your eye cream at 15% off. From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to the Potterverse. It's a podcast dedicated to the book and film universe of Harry Potter. So grab your favorite wands and time turners. Let's step into the night and pursue that flighty temptress adventure. Everybody, and welcome. My name's Mary Larson.
My name is Blake, and My name is Blake. I'm not ashamed to admit that I shed a tear or 30 during this chapter.
Oh, it's a good one.
This chapter was a special one for me.
This is what gets you hook, line, and sinker.
This one is a very special one just because it gives you so many incredible layers to each of these characters on multiple levels and in ways that you're not thinking, by the way. So, I love this chapter. It was just great. The Mirror of Erised is just, it is a concoction of mysticism and magic and love and hate and everything all combined into one that makes it such a special artifact. So I loved it.
It is totally true. Of course, this chapter is the Mirror of Erised. And my quote was, "She was a very pretty woman. She had dark red hair and her eyes. Her eyes are just like mine," Harry thought.
You're going to make me cry.
Edging a little closer to the glass. Bright green, exactly the same shape. But then he noticed that she was crying, smiling, but crying at the same time. The tall, thin, black-haired man sitting next to her put his arm around her. He wore glasses. His hair was very untidy. It stuck up at the back just like Harry's did. Harry was so close to the mirror now that his nose was nearly touching that of his reflection. "Mom," he whispered. "Dad?" They just looked at him smiling, and slowly Harry looked into the faces of the other people in the mirror and saw other pairs of green eyes just like his, other noses like his, even a little old man who looked as though he had Harry's knobbly knees. Harry was looking at his family for the first time in his life. A moment for Harry seeing his family, because he hasn't even had a picture of his parents.
Right.
He's never seen his family before. And here he is. He gets to see them moving, feeling emotions, looking at him and smiling at him. And not just his parents, but his family. And see those similarities.
And he just knows. He inherently knows that this is his family.
Yeah.
He inherently knows this is his mother. He inherently knows this is his father. Like, it is special.
It truly is.
This is what sells you, I think, on Harry the character.
I agree.
In this book.
Before we get into this chapter, we of course wanted to remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast by just searching the Potterverse in your favorite podcast app and hitting that subscribe button. That way you'll get each episode new as it comes out. You can also follow us on social media by following and searching Mary and Blake. You can also head to maryandblake.com to find all of our other podcasts and blogs. And if you enjoy this content, if it's bringing you light, if it's bringing you some lumos in your time of Nox, we would love for you
Look at you!
Hey.
Bam! Just like that. A winner!
Yeah. that a girl.
May need to use that from here on out.
You know what? Hold on. No. We need, you know what you need.
What? Oh, I get it. Yeah.
Makes me want to shout.
Good job.
Thank you.
That was really good, Mary.
If that piques your interest, please head on over to jointhenerdclan.com for as little as $2 a month. It's less than a cup of coffee. You can help contribute to our media company so we can continue to make these podcasts. I've been pretty open and honest about how between this and my Minute with Mary business, this is how I'm able to fiscally contribute to our family. And it's allowing me to be able to stay home with our kids, especially in times like this during COVID. So know that joining at jointhenerdclan.com, otherwise known as outlandercastclan.com, your contributions there mean the absolute world to Blake and I. So thank you so much. And let's get into the show.
I solemnly swear that I'm up to no good.
Well, I was going to say, by the way, Mary, that is absolutely the T-shirt for this week. Be a Lumos in a time of Knox.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
2020.
2020. Yep. I'm in.
So I realized in the last chapter, I never gave like a little chapter synopsis.
Yeah. Well, land the plane quick.
Okay. So in this chapter, it's Christmas time. The kids are really excited to go find out facts about Nicholas Flamel. Harry's Christmas present that rocks his socks is the invisibility cloak. And he goes and he finds the mirror of Erised, and then he talks to Dumbledore about it. Period.
Done. Nice job, Marvin. Much, much improved over the past few
chapters. Halloween.
Yeah, Halloween. We were still talking about it 20 minutes later.
and then this.
And then this time at band camp. Oh, man.
Want to know what's great about this chapter?
What's that?
It's the first time it snows.
Oh, that's right.
The first snowfall at Hogwarts. And I know so many of you who love the movies, you know, snow at Hogwarts, it's just a really magical sight. There's a lot of different like wallpapers that people have made. It just, I don't know, it just gives you all those nice little vibes. A lot of people rewatch the movies around Christmas, for example, because it just gives you those warm fuzzies. You picture Hedwig flying around. But the first snowfall takes place, so it's pretty exciting.
What's funny in this chapter and in the book, I think for the rest of the book, we are flying through time. I mean, we were just in the beginning of November, not in the last chapter. And now here we are in mid-December.
They've been doing a lot of studying.
Lots of studying. It goes to show a couple of things. One, it really tells you clearly that the author wants to keep each book located within a specific year.
Yes.
Each book will be one particular year.
I mean, you look at where you are, if you're holding your physical book, you know, how much time he spent actually at Hogwarts, you know, you kind of get through and it's like he's halfway through the school year and you're halfway through the bit of the book that is his time from the journey of platform 9 3/4.
Yes. And now we're getting to December and this, you know, this is a big deal, but it also shows you too, that things are happening at school, but they're happening in a way that is organic. It's not just like, okay, every week there's this big major thing. There was a troll and all of a sudden the next week it was Harry. And then all of a sudden the next week, Harry getting jinxed. And then the next week, all of a sudden it's this. And then the next week it's that. It's like, no, there's a good month and a half where nothing happens. Mm. And it's just not relevant to what the story is trying to tell. Mm. Right. So it's not important enough to know that they're just studying. You can infer from this chapter that the wheels have been turning with Harry, Ron, and Hermione. You can infer that their friendship is burgeoning, and you can infer that they have a common goal, which is, who the hell is Nicholas Flamel?
Yes.
Right? That is the key to what makes their friendship really work.
What's interesting, you know, they've got this huge mission, like you said, who is Nicholas Flamel?
Yes.
And yet they're still 11-year-old kids, you know, like they're still having this little tit for tat with Malfoy. Mm-hmm. And they're still enjoying the fact that the Weasley twins bewitched snowballs to hit Quirrell in the back of the head, which I just think is such a satisfying moment to know that In actuality, Fred and George were pegging Voldemort with snowballs.
Yeah, right.
Little did they know.
But it's important because it informs their friendship, this mm-hmm. this journey for Flamel in the information. We talked about this a couple of chapters ago where you hate when authors or showrunners or whoever force relationships on you that aren't organic. Mm-hmm. In particular, it was when Hermione was trying to stop them from going to the Midnight Duel. It was an organic way to get Hermione into this troika.
Yeah.
Now we have something that, you know, 11-year-olds develop friendships and they just have them. And that's what happens in real life. But in a book sense, in a story sense, there has to be something that unites them. And that, again, is Nicholas Flamel, the pursuit of that knowledge. And what does that mean for each character? Mm-hmm. What it means for each character, I think, is really purposed well when they're at the library. And we'll get there in a minute. But it shows you that Harry wants to discover this because he thinks he's meant to discover it. Ron, eventually you find out that he wants to stand out. He wants to be something more than what his brothers were or what he wants someone to recognize him. And Hermione, I think, takes it as a personal insult to her intelligence that she cannot figure out who Nicholas Flamel is.
And she has to leave for the Christmas holidays. Granted, she's excited to see her parents, but Ron and Harry are going to be staying at Hogwarts over Christmas time. Mm-hmm. Ron's family is traveling and Harry does not want to go home to the Dursleys. I mean, let's stay at this magical castle. No. Okay.
Yep.
But yeah, Hermione tells him like, okay guys, keep looking because I'm going to be out of here.
Can we talk about the Dursleys' present to Harry?
Oh my gosh. So he gets a total of 3 Christmas presents, which is,
yes.
Oh no, actually 4.
4. Yes.
Yeah.
Wait, no, is it 4? Yes, it is. It is 4 because he gets one from Hermione. Mm-hmm. He gets one from the Dursleys. He gets one from Dumbledore and he gets one from
Hagrid.
It is Hagrid. Yes, that's right.
Did you see the Weasleys? Yeah.
So he gets Hermione, the sweater, Dumbledore, Weasleys,
Dursleys
and Hagrid. 5 presents.
Oh, nice.
5 presents.
Nice.
Yeah. Dursleys send him a card and said, yeah, here you go. And they taped 50 pence. They just tape it to the card. Yeah. You know, it's funny because it highlights the fact that they still feel some kind of responsibility for Harry. They still feel some kind of pull towards him or obligation towards him. It is, even though it's the equivalent of sending like your third niece, like, you know, like a check for $20 for Christmas, it's still something, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's still something. Like it's more than just like it's an indication.
I think they had to give him a gift. I think that was part of like the rule when they were his caretakers to make sure that he was like cared for. Like he would get, what didn't he get for his birthday? Like a dirty pair of socks or something. I think I think part of the deal to keep that magical protection of him through the bloodline of Petunia is that they also had to give him like something as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
50 cent pence.
Yeah. And he just passes it. Ron's like, can I have it? Yeah. I'd take it. Sure.
Go for it.
Whatever.
Go for it.
I don't
Ron.
Care. But can we talk about Mrs. Weasley? How Molly is just legitimately the best. She's just the best at, like, she is your
mom goals.
If you were to think of, like, if you were to have a definition of mom in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, it should just be a picture of Molly Weasley. That's it. That's all you got.
You want a sweater? I got you.
That woman takes Harry in as her surrogate, or as her, not her surrogate son, but as her, you know,
just under her wing,
unofficial son, yeah. And gives him the same exact present that she gives to everybody.
Yeah.
And just doesn't need to give him a present. Did you ever have a friend whose mom was basically your mom?
Yes.
I did too.
I basically all of their food.
Yes. Yes. Yep. No, it's those kind of relationships are awesome.
They really are.
They're awesome.
You don't have any of the drama of like, you don't get in trouble with them really.
Yes.
You yes. know,
you just, they're kind of there for you.
You don't really like disappoint them.
Yeah. They're the mother figure, but like they don't have the total responsibility of
it's like being
your
a
mother.
Young grandma.
Yes. Being a young grandma is the best probably. No, but, and it's also important because it sheds light on what Harry is going through when he's in this world. He doesn't want to go back to the Dursleys because they may be his family, like by blood, but they're not his family.
And you know that Christmas morning, listening to Dudley open his millions of gifts is yes. just like hands and nails on a chalkboard to Harry.
Yep, absolutely.
So he chooses to stay at Hogwarts. He gets to learn about wizard chess.
Let me amplify on one other yes. thing. Something that I think is coming out of all of this, especially at the end of this chapter from what you read, mm-hmm. Harry at the end of this chapter, when he's looking at his family, he doesn't consider the Dursleys his family. He mm-hmm. sees his family in the mirror and he says, this is the first, and the writing says, this is the first time he's laid eyes yeah. on his family.
Yeah.
But I think what's more important is that Harry already has family. Just because your family is blood doesn't necessarily mean that they are family. And just because friends are not blood doesn't mean they're not family either. Yeah. He does have an adoptive family. It's the Weasleys and it's everybody that's at Hogwarts.
Mm-hmm. Which he ends up also marrying into that family too.
That's true. Good point.
Nice choice, Harry. Nice choice. All right. So yeah, the holidays, he's there. He learns how to play wizard's chess. We learn a little bit how the wizard's chess actually physically battle each other and mm-hmm. how the sets really, grow attached to the people who own them. So that was a fun little bit. And then all the food, once again, how the boys were just roasting different things. I just love how the author weaves in all these scrumptious smells and tastes. So that way when you're reading, it just kind of like incorporates all these different senses. It helps you feel like you're part of this cozy, warm, yummy holiday feel happening at Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the presents happen and he gets this really mysterious package. He does. He gets a cute flute from Hagrid. Mm-hmm. He gets the sweater, but he gets this mysterious package and it's the invisibility cloak.
Right.
And it says, this was your father's. He left it to me before he died. And I wanted to pass it on to you, but it's not signed by anybody.
No, no. Eventually we discover that it is Dumbledore who does mm-hmm. give him the invisibility cloak. And he's already giving him one of the Deathly Hallows. Dumbledore knows that this is one of the Deathly Hallows,
yes.
right? So he's already preparing Harry for much later on down the road in his battle with Voldemort by giving him this. It's also giving him a connection to his father, of course, and in the previous life before him. And it's no coincidence that Dumbledore does give this gift, knowing, I think, that the Mirror of Erised is going to be discovered.
He gives him the invisibility cloak, knowing that he's going to find that?
Yeah, I think Dumbledore knows that Harry is getting himself into things, or at least he has an idea that Harry is getting himself into things. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he gives him the invisibility cloak to help aid whatever Harry is doing. And why is that? Because Dumbledore knows that Harry is on a path mm-hmm. and he has to have the tools for that.
I mean, path. He even writes in the letter, use it well.
Right. Exactly. So implicit in that is that Dumbledore knows and that Harry needs that as a tool.
So why do you think that this invisibility cloak did not blow up in the explosion of the house in Godric's Hollow when Voldemort murdered James and Lily Potter? Why do you think it was left in Dumbledore's possession?
That's a good question. Probably because it makes me wonder if James knew it was a Deathly Hallows then.
I mean, James is a descendant of the Peveril family who yeah. are the original Deathly Hallows owners.
Right.
So, you know, I would believe that I mean, he has an invisibility cloak. Like, it really works. So if you read the tales of Beetle and the Bard, you can put maybe two and two together. And if rumor had it about the Peverils, like, you know your family tree. So maybe James did know that this could be one of the Deathly Hallows. I like to think that James lent it to Dumbledore, that maybe because, you know, they were in the Order of the Phoenix, maybe Dumbledore was going on a mission and James was like, here, you can use this. Mm-hmm. I know you know about the Hallows. Like, you probably need this to go sneak around and try to capture Voldemort.
Sure, sure. I think there's a lot at play here. There's a lot of subtext to why Dumbledore gives him this cloak, what its purpose is, and it, not only its purpose in the immediacy, but in the way future as well. I think something also happens here too, is that the author, at least in the beginning of this chapter, gives you full character, another entrance into full characterization via these gifts, right? So Hermione gives Harry the chocolate frogs because mm-hmm. that's what he loves. Mm-hmm. That is something that that's what he loves. Dumbledore gives this invisibility cloak for reasons that we just discussed. Molly Weasley gives the sweater, which is a symbol of warmth and love,
like,
and
hug.
Care, and it's a hug, and it's and it's handmade. It is written. It is made by her hand. It is something that she gives to her entire family every year. She is admitting to Harry that he is part of her family, and it is something that is an equal gift. It doesn't matter if you're Harry Potter. It doesn't matter if you're Ron Weasley. It doesn't matter if you're Bill Weasley. It doesn't matter if you're Charlie. It doesn't matter if you're Mr. Weasley. You're getting one of these. They are all equal in her eyes. The Dursleys give him the 50 pence. And then lastly, Hagrid gives him this flute. It is a rugged, handmade, magical flute that sounds like an owl. It is something that is earthbound. It is something that is rough and not perfect. It symbolizes Hagrid, but it also symbolizes for Harry creativity and learning to accept that part of himself, something that Hagrid, I think, wants to help keep Harry going.
Yeah.
You know, and I think these gifts are a huge part in the characterizations of the characters that are giving this stuff to Harry.
Very cool. Very
Not
cool.
Bad,
we're
huh?
getting some. We're getting some clarification. Dumbledore had the cloak and the Elder Wand. Did he also have the Infinity Stone being placed in the gold? Oh, I don't know about yet. But basically, a couple of people clarified that James Potter had lent the invisibility cloak to Dumbledore at that time because Dumbledore was trying to figure out if it was a Deathly Hallow.
Got it. Okay, so there you go. Not bad.
So here goes Harry. Christmas night, he's just so excited about this gift. And one of the sweetest things about it is not just that it's an invisibility cloak and he can now go anywhere in the castle that he wants undetected.
Oh, by the way, it's not an Infinity Stone.
What?
That's from Marvel. It's the Sorcerer's Stone.
Sorcerer's.
I'm sorry. No, the not the Sorcerer's Stone. The Resurrection Stone.
Oh my God, our brains.
I know.
Too many stones.
Way too many stones.
Oh my goodness.
Way
gracious.
Too many nerd things. Hold on, I'll play it. There we go. And I'll also play this. Okay, there we go.
He's excited not just to explore, but the fact that this was his dad's cloak.
Right.
Like, makes you realize he hasn't had anything passed down to him from his dad. It's not like Petunia and Vernon had a box of, like, this was your dad's stuff. This was his t-shirt. This was his yearbook. Like,
right.
Here's some of his favorite books. He didn't have any of that. So now he has this cloak that is magical, is going to allow him to go towards achieving some more of his goals. But his dad did it. So he's doing Quidditch just like his dad did. Now he gets his dad's cloak. And this is why all these different ties of family mean so much, as Harry just gets more and more enveloped into Hogwarts and into this magical world. Mm-hmm. It is home to him.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wonder what you're laughing.
I'm just laughing at the Infinity Stone.
Oh, so many nerddoms. We talked about the friendship between Hermione, Ron, and Harry and how it is propped up by the search for Nicholas Flamel. And when I was reading this chapter, something that stood out to me was how they all approached their search for the information about Nicholas Flamel, Harry goes straight to the restricted section, which, again, if you squint, you can see it. Something is there, that something is pulling, and I want to talk about that. But it shows that little bit of side character in Harry. It gives you further characterization.
Yeah, because Hermione told him, right. And he knew, I want to go in there.
But it gives you characterization without having to tell you, hey, look at me! You know, and it's not being basic. It's giving you something without having to... It's giving you something real about Harry. The same thing goes for Ron. Ron just goes and it's just picking books, random books up. Okay, sure. Oh, Full Mount, no. Okay, next book. Not even paying attention, nothing. Hermione is my bride. Making lists upon lists upon lists and checking every single book. I mean, fine-tooth comb and just making sure she has...
What about an Excel document?
Oh, it's color coded and it's italicized and bolded. We got ones and twos, guaranteed.
That's ones that are highlighted, didn't have Flamel mentioned, but is on my must read list.
She's got so many things happening right now. Yeah. But I find that such great characterization. It's telling you who these people are without actually telling you who these people are. It is the fine details that the author does, these little things that she introduces that makes her writing so special. It was what makes this book work so well.
So we get Harry actually going to the restricted section, feeling invincible, and he gets a book that is way too loud, and of course all of a sudden Filch and Snape we hear running on in, because Snape has asked Filch to let him know if anybody wanders around at night, and Filch does that. So once again we're seeing this relationship between Filch and Snape,
right,
helping each other out. And what's interesting is that, you know, why do you think Snape cares about people walking around at night? Because he's trying to keep his eye on Quirrell.
Oh, good point.
Right? Okay, Filch probably never sleeps, knows everybody around in the castle. And so here's Snape being like, tell me if anybody, he said, Filch says, you asked me to come directly to you, Professor, if anyone was wandering around at night.
Yep.
And somebody's been in the library, restricted section.
Yep.
So I think Filch feels really cool because Snape is his buddy right now. And he likes that Snape's kind of mean and, you know, kind of tough to the other kids. And Filch is really into that. And here's Snape being like, if anyone's walking around, I'm not going to name names, but if anybody is, let me know so he can keep his eye on Quirrell.
You know, one other thing that happens here too is Harry, again, I know we talked about it earlier. Harry goes straight to the restricted section and he doesn't ask for help. He doesn't ask a teacher for help. And I understand him not wanting to ask Snape, but why wouldn't he ask Professor McGonagall? Why wouldn't he ask Professor Sprout? Why wouldn't he ask Flitwick? Why wouldn't he ask any of these people? Does he know what he's doing is inherently wrong, number one? And if he knows what he's doing is inherently wrong, what is pulling him? So I feel like something is pulling him towards this restricted section. And because when he goes there, he senses that the books are whispering, knowing that someone is in there that's not supposed to be. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
And wasn't Voldemort's diary in the restricted section?
I don't know. I mean, the diary, I'll have to check because, I mean, it's with the Malfoys who then give it to Ginny.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So
they give it to Ginny. Never mind. You're right.
Hanging out
you're
there.
Right. You're right. Right. But you still, know, regardless.
You could think that the dark arts books that talk about how to make a Horcrux are speaking to Harry since he himself is a Horcrux.
Absolutely, because the Horcrux knowledge is in the restricted section.
You just got deep, man.
I mean,
just got deep. I think.
You know what? I'm going to give myself.
It makes me want to shout. I mean, I'll go undeep and just say that his really smart friend Hermione was probably suggested, you know, head on over there.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But what prevents her from going to the restricted section.
She doesn't have an invisibility cloak.
No, but
students can't get in there.
No, but when they were in the library initially, all three of them together, she's the one making lists and he's the one that goes straight for the restricted section.
Yeah.
Why isn't it her that goes to the restricted section?
She's too busy making her lists.
All I'm saying is it just feels like something is there and it feels like something is pulling him, whether it is, you know, other Horcrux materials. The text says the books are whispering and it's there for a reason. It's there for a reason.
Okay.
I don't know what it is yet, but it's there for a reason.
Okay. So Harry tries to escape because Filch and Snape are running around and he bumbles around into this empty room, and it's not so empty as there is a big mirror there, just like straight up, just a big old mirror. And he sees his family.
Oh,
he sees his family's reflection in there. Now the words above the mirror, reads, "I show not your face, but your heart's desire." That's like what it ends up meaning.
Mm-hmm. And Erised is desire backwards.
Yeah. So it's, if you, if you read the text backwards, because it says Erised, Stra, Iru, Oyet, whatever. If you read that sentence backwards, that's what it says. "I show not your face, but your heart's desire."
Right.
And this is a type of writing called mirror writing. So if you were to write things backwards.
Oh, like Redrum.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Perfect. So yeah, he gets to see his family, which is pretty cool. And he gets to see these physical similarities like we talked about in the beginning of this episode, just how it pulls at Harry so incredibly much. And what's kind of weird is that, was Dumbledore in the room at this point?
No.
Because Dumbledore says to him,
"Oh, you're back again."
Yeah.
Right. So Dumbledore, again, the text,
like, was Dumbledore just like creeping in the back, like watching Harry try to get this book and then like following him around, like he, yeah, exactly. So, he says, "You're here again," when he comes back to the room, you know, later.
So when we were saying earlier in this book, like Dumbledore is moving things to get Harry on a path, this right here suggests that we're right. Dumbledore knows that Harry is with the Mirror of Erised. And the Mirror of Erised is in a room that it's really not supposed to be in. It's just in this classroom. It's just in this room that's random.
It's not under the trapdoor with Fluffy. It is eventually.
Right, but it's not,
but it's
now.
Not now.
So what I,
so where's the stone now? Is the stone in this mirror now? Is the stone in Dumbledore's office? Are they still building this like multi trap thing, or is the stone already in the mirror now in this random classroom?
I mean, it could be, but if, and if, but it would, again, Dumbledore knows that Harry is doing it, so that means he knows that if it is in the mirror,
Harry will understand.
Right, but not only that, he also must know that there is some confusion about Fluffy and all the things that are happening, whether it's Professor Snape or it is Fluffy getting, you know, budged in on by the three.
Dumbledore is so 2020. Like, really? We don't have a real plan? We're just going to try a lot of different things and see what sticks.
We're going to throw crap against the wall and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's like when you test pasta and you take the pasta and you throw it up on the cabinet. Nope, not ready yet.
Let's see what's up with Quirrell. I still don't know yet.
Still not sure yet.
Let's see if that Fluffy trap's ready. Not ready yet. You know what it needs? A mirror.
So is he intentionally, number either one, moving the stone, the Sorcerer's Stone, or two, is he intentionally putting the stone in the mirror and moving the mirror all throughout the school? One, to keep it safe, but two, put it in a place that's so obvious that Harry will get to it. And when Harry runs, is Hogwarts molding itself so that Harry gets to the mirror at Dumbledore's wishes?
Like, are those stairways and hallways changing? Right.
It's not a coincidence that Harry, again, is running for his life and ends up back again in the Forbidden Corridor without even realizing where he's supposed to be.
No, he's not in the Forbidden Corridor. The mirror isn't in the Forbidden Corridor.
Doesn't matter.
You're just saying.
Stats are for nerds.
Okay.
What I'm saying is he's running for his life, and all of a sudden he just happens to be or to come upon the Mirror of Erised, mm-hmm. which is the one thing at the end of this book that will that is the climax of this book. There's no way. Either one, that's really lazy writing, which I don't believe, mm-hmm. or two, it's there by design. And if Dumbledore knows that Harry has been there multiple times, implicit in that is that he knows that this is done on purpose, that the Harry has been led there. So either it's Hogwarts as a school, as a living, breathing entity, pushing Harry towards the Mirror of Erised, or it's Dumbledore. Which do you think it is?
Both. I don't know. Jury's out.
Oh, fine.
We see the Grey Lady in this chapter. They pass by the Grey Lady, and it excited me. So when Harry wakes Ron up, he's like, guess what, Ron? You can see my family. I found this cool mirror. He wakes Ron up. They run on over. Ron, of course, doesn't see Harry's family. He sees himself alone, head boy, Quidditch captain, like all these things that Harry, who's last son in this long line of amazing and outstanding sons, he sees what he wants for, you know, what would bring him great joy and what his goal is right then and there. So they go on back, and as they're walking out, it says they pass the ghost of a tall witch gliding in the opposite direction, but saw no one else. That's it. That's all we hear. But the author has come out saying that was the Grey Lady.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
It's just that little.
Oh,
that's Helena Ravenclaw.
Oh, that is good stuff. Yeah. That is good stuff. I guess that there's something so there's something so captivating about the Mirror of Erised. Not just because you get to see your innermost desires, mm-hmm. which obviously is captivating in and of itself. I mean, to see something that is your innermost desire and just have it right there in front of you. But I find it so important that Harry goes through a journey of trying to find out information about Nicholas Flamel in a library, in books, and having no success. Yet he sees the Mirror of Erised, where he has to look within himself and gets lost within himself and the mirror does what it is meant to do, which is show you everything that you've ever wanted. And it keeps you there, and it keeps you there to a point where everything loses its everything that is in front of it loses itself.
I mean, it says how long he stood there, he didn't know. The reflections did not fade, and he looked and looked until a distant noise brought him back to his senses. And this is why I think Dumbledore was watching him.
Sure.
Because we hear that a distant noise brings him back to his senses. He doesn't find out what that distant noise was. And then as he and Ron are looking at the mirror together, they also hear a noise. It's actually like they're looking at it, and Ron's like, oh, I'm holding the Quidditch cup and da 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 da, don't push me. A sudden noise outside in the corridor put an end to their discussion. They hadn't realized how loudly they were talking. Mm-hmm. So, oh, it was Mrs. Norris. But still, like, Dumbledore realizes that he's been there before. Because he says to him, because Harry then goes back, you know, he just goes back without Ron. He's like, I'm going to go see my parents again. And everyone's smiling. And he says, so back again, Harry. And then Dumbledore ends up saying, oh, he asks him, how did you know? How did you know that I was here? But then Dumbledore also says, it showed your friend Ron himself as head boy. And Harry says, how did you know? So Dumbledore was there, like in the room, and he says, you don't need a cloak to become invisible. So he was there listening to these boys talking about what they're seeing. Mm-hmm. So I agree. It's like he gave him this cloak, and maybe Dumbledore is bored. Okay. It's Christmas night. He gave Harry a really cool present. It's the invisibility cloak. He wants to see what he does with it. And Dumbledore can just be invisible by himself. So he just like moses around and follows people around. But This is where he explains, "Let me explain. The happiest man on earth would be able to use the mirror of Erised like a normal mirror. That is, he would look into it and see himself exactly as he is. It shows us what we want, whatever we want. It shows us nothing more or less than our deepest, most desperate desires of our hearts." And then he tells him that the mirror is going to have a new home. "And I ask you to not go looking for it again. If you ever do run across it, you will now be prepared."
Oh, so yeah, obviously it's, hey, don't touch the big red button. That's what it is. That's what that is.
But if you do, now you know how it works.
Right, exactly. So don't screw it up.
Yeah.
Don't do what you just did, because what ended up happening was that it takes Harry off of his path. It makes Harry not care about finding Nicholas Flamel. It makes Harry and Ron fight over who gets to use it, and it drives a wedge between the two, because he's saying, "What are you like?" I love when Harry says, "You're just going to be head boy. It's about Quidditch. It doesn't matter. I want to see my family." It's such a unique thing that happens, and that Dumbledore, I think, obviously knows the power of it, mm-hmm. but I think he knows that Harry has to see it, because part of Harry's journey is a level of introspection. He has to figure out who he is and what his innermost desire is, because later on in the book, his innermost desire has to come out, and that is protecting, you know,
knowing where the stone is, not to use it.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting because Dumbledore doesn't tell him, "Oh, by the way, that present was from me. Mm-hmm. You're welcome for the invisibility cloak." He just, you know, like, "Oh yeah, we can both be invisible now." And Harry asks him, like, "What would you see if you looked into the mirror?" Which I think is such a deep question, once again, for an 11-year-old boy to be asking of the headmaster that's caught him now sneaking around the castle. And he said, "I see myself holding a pair of thick woolen socks. One can never have enough socks. Another Christmas has come and gone. I didn't get a single pair. People will insist on giving me books." And I love this. It was only when he was back in bed that it struck Harry that Dumbledore might not have been quite truthful.
Isn't it? There's a vague memory that I have is that when Dumbledore looks into the mirror of Erised, he sees Grindelwald.
Oh.
Don't I remember that from somewhere. Fantastic Beasts?
It might be. I don't know. I'll find out, or our friends on Facebook will help us.
I am like almost 99% sure that it's Grindelwald. That's what he sees.
Okay. We will return back to this.
Effort that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so I think that's
the whole bit where it's like, he said he wouldn't want a pair of socks. Now we know that Dumbledore loves knitting patterns. We know that he would appreciate a well-darned sock, as we all all would love a great pair of socks,
right?
Especially when it's cold. Thank you. But this is Harry's first inkling that Dumbledore may not be sharing all of the truth with him.
Right, and it's funny that this also comes too, because remember, Dumbledore and Harry have not had a conversation yet. They've not had an honest conversation with each other, or they haven't had a congenial conversation like this at all. And you get the immediate interpretation that Dumbledore is this real fatherly figure for Harry immediately, like just right off the jump. Yet at the same time, Harry also knows that Dumbledore may not be telling the truth. It's such a weird and awesome juxtaposition in that relationship.
The author said that at this stage of Dumbledore's life, he saw his own family, especially his dead sister.
Oh, Ariana. Okay.
But you are correct that the Crimes of Grindelwald, he would have been seeing he and Grindelwald's younger selves.
Weren't they doing the oath?
Yes, the blood oath.
Yes, okay. All right, yep, okay. Now I remember. All right.
Ta-da!
See, now I knew that memory was in there. I had to pull it out and put it into the pensieve.
Okay. Can you take someone's perspective? You got a couple of fun characters. Okay, you've got Dumbledore, you've got Filch, you've got Snape, but we just did Snape in the last episode. You have Ron. Ron, who's spending a Merry Christmas with Harry because his family's all away. You have Hermione.
I don't know. Who do I want?
I don't know who you want.
No, I think you should do it because no. Who do I want?
I go for Ron.
I kind of want to do Ron. Because screw Harry.
Yeah.
Screw Harry, dude.
Well, think about how fun of a Christmas this is for Ron, okay? He's usually like, it's loud and there's tons of siblings all over the place, and he gets to be at Hogwarts with his best friend.
Right.
You know, and yes, a couple of his brothers there, Fred and George, are still there, but he's not with his annoying sister, Ginny, okay? Mm-hmm. Who he has to probably like follow around and like clean up after, even though she's only 10. he doesn't have his big brothers probably playing pranks on him. He doesn't have to share anything. He just gets to really enjoy his time with his best friend. And Ron is really good at wizard's chess.
Yes, exactly.
This is something he's good at.
And this is a big deal because, again, the author introducing these small things so that later on in the book, when they are playing wizard's chess for fracking real, you already have an understanding that Ron's really good at it. And it's already a part of their wizard life. You understand that something is bigger than just the chess of it all. It's or the game of it. It's bigger. It's She introduces it very well, and I'm so thankful that she does.
Yeah.
But you know what? Screw Harry, because...
What?
Yeah, no. Yeah. Your family, your dead family. Yeah, I get it. Listen to me. I'm the head boy. All I want to do is just look at this friggin' mirror. You've been sitting in front of it all day yesterday, and I want to sit here for, you know, give me like 10 minutes, man.
You know, it is so funny because Harry is born into fame. He has this natural ability to be an exceptional Quidditch player.
Sure.
He is the chosen one. And Ron is like the rent. He's actually very tall, but he's like the youngest boy in this family. And he's average in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. In most things, Ron is quite average. So it makes sense that this 11-year-old boy, it is what he wants. He wants to be great. He wants to excel. He wants people to see him. And that might mean having to win awards or have prestigious titles because that's what he's seen of his siblings. You know, they talk about how Charlie Weasley was a great Quidditch player. They talk about, you know, Percy is a prefect. So he's able to see all these things that have been modeled to him from his older brothers. And some of these dreams do come true for Ron.
Yes.
You know, he becomes head boy. He does play Quidditch. He's not the captain. He certainly would not.
But he's the keeper. And he's a damn good keeper.
Yeah, you know, that's questionable as well. He's a good keeper. And he does play an important role. But this goes to show you, you know, as we move on to the future books with this series, Ron wants to be special. Ron wants to find his place. Harry was born into his place, whether he liked it or not. And he always kind of had to become comfortable with that or find his own way with that. And yep. Ron continually tries to find his way to shine.
Veronica makes a great point here on Facebook. She says, Ron and Harry desire the other person's life.
Yes. Yes.
At all times.
100%.
Yes, totally. Great point, Veronica. Excellent, excellent job.
Aside from Ginny being Ron's sister.
Yeah. That'd be kind of weird. That'd be a little incesty.
Oh yeah. Just a wee bit.
But it's that tension between the two of them that makes them...
It challenges their friendship.
Yeah, it makes them so strong. That tension of what each other have and recognizing that... Like, Harry is sitting there looking at his family. They're not real. That's not really them. It's just, like, another thing, too, I have a question of is all the family behind his parents in the mirror. Even his parents, is it just his interpretation of what his parents would be?
Mm.
Right? Is the mirror something that evokes the soul, or is it just showing you what you want to see?
I don't know. You stumped me there. You stumped me good. But in regards to Ron, I think, you know, you're talking about the friendship between he and Harry. And I think that, yes, they do want aspects of each other's lives, mm-hmm. and each other's kind of strength is often the other person's weakness.
Right.
And it isn't until the latter books that they truly appreciate this, because it's not that Harry's never proud that he's the chosen one. That's why I'm saying in the Quidditch chapter previously, you know, he's not one to gloat. He's not the one to say, yes, I'm taking the glory. Like even when he's in the Goblet of Fire, in that book, in the Triwizard Tournament, you know, he's not necessarily super pumped. Eventually he's kind of like, well, this is kind of cool, but I'm really kind of scared. And this is weird that this happened. Mm-hmm. Whereas Ron would love that. And he eventually, even in that book, finds out like these things happen to Harry and he's not happy about it. He just wants to fly under the radar.
Yep. They both, you know, Veronica said they both desire each other's life. But the funny thing is that both of them give each other that life. Ron wants to be special. He wants to stand out. And his friendship with Harry helps him do that. The challenging from Harry pushes Ron to do things that his family probably could never do in many ways. And Harry, as he's looking at this mirror, looking at his family, Ron is right there. Ron is there with him. Yes, he wants to look at his family. I get he wants to look at his mom and dad. And again, I cried. Like, it was very powerful for me. But Ron is his family right there. He doesn't have to look at a mirror. He can see it.
You know, it's weird because sometimes I feel like Harry is Frodo. If you were to compare characters from this and the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know, like the chosen one has to really go through a lot of pain and suffering and has to kind of be okay with dying and, you know, just kind of things happening. And then you've got, of course, Samwise,
right,
who is Frodo's friend. He's there through him with thick and thin. And I got to tell you, I like Sam better than Ron.
Because Sam never abandons Frodo. Let me ask you this. Is the Mirror of Erised the One Ring?
No.
No?
No.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure because
I would say if there was one ring to rule them all, it would be the Deathly Hallows.
No, it would be the Horcruxes.
Are we going to have this battle? Horcruxes versus Hallows? What are we, book 7?
I know. No, but I feel like, at least in terms of this book, the Mirror of Erised is the one ring to rule them all. Because the Mirror of Erised, if we're making this connection...
You just got real deep.
I know. We're going full nerd clan right
here. I was
here.
Just trying to say that Sam's a better friend. Potatoes.
I wonder, because the ring changes a person. Mm-hmm. Right. By the way, let me just play this right off the jump.
Nerd!
Okay. The ring changes a person, right? It alters their reality. So they only see the ring. The Mirror of Erised is altering Harry's reality. So he only sees the mirror. All he cares about at this moment is the mirror.
I mean, for that moment, but he is pulled away by something as simple as a sound in the distance. So I wouldn't say that it's like all encompassing. I mean, the ring literally drives people crazy. So I disagree. The ring has more power over the mirror.
I don't know.
This is a fun game. Like, take nerd things and what's more important and better.
Infinity Stones or the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yes. Would the Sorcerer's Stone trump the Infinity Stone? I say no. I say Infinity Stone.
Would the Resurrection Stone trump the Infinity Stones?
Too many stones.
Way too many stones. I don't know. I think it's a good question that you bring up here.
Okay. My question? I've gotten really lost. My brain is mush. My mic keeps falling.
Fine. Fair enough. We were supposed to be in Ron's perspective.
I tried.
We did try. We tried a lot.
One. One.
Oh,
love you.
One. My little one.
Let's close this up.
No, we got some emails.
Okay.
We got some emails. Let's see. This one comes from Becky. She says, I have a pretty obvious question.
I love Becky.
12.
I love Becky so much. And you want to know why?
Why?
Finding Dory. Oh. And one of my best friends, her name is Becky. And whenever I read it or I hear it and it's not like in proper context of like, hi, Becky, how are you? I think of Becky.
Aruru, Becky. Aruru. I love
Becky, if you're listening, you need to watch Finding Dory if you haven't.
I love the shirts that have the picture of Becky and it just says trust Becky.
I've never seen that.
That's the best. I love that shirt. Okay. Becky says, a pretty obvious question. Mary, what would you see in the mirror of Erised? And follow-up question, do you think what you see changes throughout your life? Mary, yes. What would you see?
I do believe it changes throughout your life because we know that from Dumbledore. What would I see? Okay. What you would see today, August 5th, 2020, is me in a room by myself with a big bed and a bag of Doritos all to myself, an eye mask, and some melatonin.
I'm asking melatonin and maybe a big bag of weed.
No, yeah. No. This is a safe podcast for children's ears, Blake.
Sorry, you're right. You're right. You're right.
I wouldn't do that anyway. That's what I would want.
A bag
That's
of
my
Doritos?
Deepest my deepest desire at this moment, Becky.
Oh.
Simple.
Man.
And concise.
Oh man.
How about you, Blake? You're done.
Now that I already know, I've been thinking about this question all day. My deepest desire, and now I feel really bad because you just gave your answer.
Mine's awesome.
Mine is...
yours is going to be like deep and sappy and stuff, isn't it?
Mine would be sitting next to my wife alone. On a house, on the deck, on the ocean. Just no worries. Just nothing to do.
Some Hakuna Matata playing.
Just sit on the deck in a house that we own on the ocean with my wife, holding hands. That's what I want.
Nope. I don't want anyone touching me.
Don't touch me. Don't touch me.
My children all day touch me.
Oh, man. Here I am trying to I've been thinking about this freaking thing all day, and you're talking about a bag of Doritos and melatonin.
Hey, listen, it's our 10-year anniversary in 2 days. The honeymoon's over. Mama needs a break.
Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it.
I love you. I'll hang out with you on the water on Friday.
Yeah, great. Great. Awesome.
And then on Saturday, I want the bed to myself.
All right,
no,
so,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So if anybody else has questions for us,
someone, if you could scroll up, is asking... if we would be more upfront, Anna Ashley, go down. Anna Ashley says, would you, either of you, be more upfront than Dumbledore has been in the end? Or would you have held back as much as he did? Could be a teaser for those that don't already know.
I don't know how you could tell an 11-year-old that he is a pig for slaughter.
Lamb. Sure. Severus is lamb.
Sure, he's a lamb for slaughter. Fine. Stats are for nerds. I don't know how you could tell him that. I don't even know how much, I really don't know how much you can tell a kid. One that you tried to protect initially.
Well, he doesn't know at this point that Harry is a Horcrux. He does know that neither can live while the other survives. He knows that much. So I don't think I'd be telling him yet because I'd be like, let me see what this Potter kid can do. Voldemort's not back yet.
Maybe.
Okay, like we're cool. Like maybe he is super duper magical, but like only one of them can live. So it's kind of like a 50-50, all right? I'm going to take some chances. But then when he finds out that Harry's a Horcrux.
But at this point, like maybe he isn't being totally upfront. But he is, and as we discussed pretty in depth here, he is guiding things for Harry, making sure that he gets the right tools, making sure he gets put into the right places, making sure that he gets the right information. So he can beat him. And you're seeing it. We just talked about it for 20 minutes on this podcast. You're seeing it right from the beginning. So...
I wouldn't tell him right now.
I probably wouldn't tell him either. All right. Angela says, I had a question about the Quidditch rules because the sports fan in me is having a struggle. If you win the game when the seeker catches the snitch, why are the other people playing and getting their asses kicked trying to get the score and block goals if it doesn't matter? Is playing the game just basically a tiebreaker if neither seeker catches the snitch? If so, that is kind of weak to go through all that work and only matters that both seekers suck.
So the way that Quidditch scores, you know how like football's weird and it's like you can get 6 points if you score a touchdown, but then like one more point if you put the extra point,
and then 2 points with a safety.
Yeah, okay, it's just as crazy as that.
Or 3 points for a field goal.
Like, why can't we just get 1, 2, 3 points? Okay, like what's going on? So Quidditch is as bonkers as football scoring. If the people throwing the quaffles, the equivalent of like soccer in a goal, the chasers throw a quaffle through one of the hoops, they get 10 points. Whereas when the seeker catches the snitch, they get 150 points. So technically, if the game goes on really long, if that snitch is hiding and you just can't find it, if a team gets 15 quaffle goals through the goalposts, they're already at 150 points.
Right.
So you either need to score 15 goals to tie, but you need 16 more goals to beat the other team who has
But that's
snitch.
If the other team has no score.
You need to have 16 more goals than the other team, no matter what.
Yes, yeah, okay, yeah.
16
yeah.
more goals than
and
the other team.
And the game, Quidditch will go on. I think earlier in the book, they said Ron and George and...
Fred.
George and Fred said that, or was it Wood, said that a game went on for 3 months.
Yes.
And they had to keep putting people in and out. And the getting the snitch does get the team 150 points. But that doesn't mean the team automatically wins. More than likely, they will win because 150 points is 150 points. But getting the snitch only ends the game, right? So it kind of reminds me of Risk. You win the game of Risk, not because somebody controls the whole board, but because at the halfway through the deck or a two-thirds way through the deck, there's that card that says game over. So, and whatever who is left and whatever you count up how many countries you have in Risk, and that's the end of the game, and whoever has the most wins.
Yeah.
So the same thing goes for.
I mean, so you could think like if a team had, say, Slytherin had 170 points and Gryffindor had zero. Okay, Harry would not catch that snitch right away. Mm-hmm. He'd instead be kind of like guarding the snitch and keeping the Slytherin seeker away so he could hope that his team could score 3 goals.
Yep.
And then he could catch it.
You know, I'm part of me kind of thinks that I would see my mom in the mirror.
You totally would.
I part of me does. And as I was reading, I was thinking about that. And all I kept thinking of, was Star Wars episode 2 when Anakin sees his, every time I see this scene, I sob because Anakin in episode 2 is 18 and his mother, obviously spoilers, dies when he's 18 in her arms. And I was 18 when my mother died. And I was 18 when that movie came out, back in 2002, whatever it was. There was a lot of feels for me. And all I could think of was when Anakin's mother says to him, "Oh, Anakin, you're my boy. You're so handsome. I'm so proud of you." Like, oh my God, I'm getting upset thinking about it just because I feel like that's what my mother would say to me. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. But I, you know, "You're so handsome. I'm so proud of you. And I love you." And like the whole thing. And just as a mother, that's what you say to your kid. Like,
yeah.
All I could think of is that too. So
your mirror is much better than mine.
Well, both of my mirrors are better than your Doritos and freaking melatonin.
This is what 2020's brought me to, Blake.
It's a wild night. That's going to be the next t-shirt. It's just going to be a bag of Doritos and a bottle of melatonin.
In an IMAX.
2020.
Oh, man.
Yep.
Bam! Just like that. A winner!
Oh, man.
Let's wrap this one up.
All right, let's go. Let's close it out. We're already an hour or two. All right, let's do it.
Hey, Blake.
Hey, Mary.
You said that we got some new iTunes reviews, huh?
We did. You better hurry up.
Oh, my gosh. Well, what? Why does this make your heart a flutter?
Just because it's, you know, we got more reviews, and they're all nice reviews. And, you know, we want the written ones that helps get the podcast out to the world. It's part of the word of mouth that we always try to get out there for all the listeners and for the people who are trying to discover Harry Potter and the Potterverse. So thank you very much for everybody doing the reviews. Mary, you gotta start talking because I'm
vamping
too hot.
We want to thank Lil Zaza, who says entertaining. Mary and Blake are real entertainers. How blessed to find each other.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. So.
Yeah. Sorry, if you feel like you're really blessed or we really, you know, have a good show here, please go to jointhenerdclan.com and support what we do at Mary and Blake Media.
Or you can send me red Doritos, not blue, red.
And melatonin. Maybe an eye mask.
All right, guys, thank you so much once again for tuning in to this episode of the Potterverse. We'll be back for you soon. Don't forget, you could sign up for our complimentary texting reminders by texting the phone number 81010 and in the message at Elderwand. For now, my name's Mary.
My name is Blake.
Mischief managed.